15 past again, so we probably should start. So today we practice a little bit more with types. I noticed last time that types, as usual and as expected, are causing slight difficulties, especially the combination of functions and type variables, which seems to be hard for everyone, as it pretty much should be. It's a novel concept, so we have a few more questions with these. Then we talk about program properties and proofs by induction. And we talk about quick check, which is a very nice tool. I basically talk about quick check in every course I visit. It's, you know, if I go to software testing, I talk about quick check. If I go to, you know, software security course, I will talk about quick check. So it's something that I like to talk about. And I don't know if it's this season that I have this abominable spring fatigue, but I really can't figure out any true-false questions about program properties, proofs by induction, or even quick check. So we have a bit less of these, you know, multiple choice questions and talking with our friends. Instead, what I thought I would do is throw balls at you, or cubes, as it seems to be. So this is a microphone. It's for you to ask questions. Only user instructions I got is that, well, don't knock your friends over with this. And if you are talking, just hold it in your hand. If you put it on the table, it will stop recording. And we play with this a bit instead of these questions. Warning, last time I, you know, had these group discussions where we threw a ball to the next guy who is going to talk. Ended up that we were working in this big lecture hall in the sports building. It's something like seats 300 people or so. There's one guy that is really asleep in one corner. The ball is on the far end of the classroom. And, you know, the guy at that end of the classroom decides that he's going to go really a long throw. And I used a tennis ball, rather hard and heavy tennis ball. And, you know, when the ball is flying in the middle of the classroom, I'm, you know, pretty much picturing what is going to happen. I almost get to warn the guy, but then he's just looking the other way. And so let's try to avoid. This is much softer ball, but that's what caused me to stop this practice for a few years. So, okay. Before beginning, I thought that we might try to use this funny-looking microphone. So if you have any worries or concerns about how the course is going, meaning that I should be talking about some different topic, or perhaps I should be demonstrating how to complete some exercise, that's a good question. Now is an excellent time to make requests. I'm prepared to spend some small bit of the beginning of this lecture to just answer questions and write example codes if there are reasonable requests. And the protocol is I throw this around, you throw it not back at me, but to your friends. So if you have nothing to say, you can pick the next victim, you know, someone who is looking very shy and pale, you throw it at him or her, and then that person gets to say something. And if you have nothing to say, you can say just, I have nothing to say. So any worries or concerns, other questions, requests for code demonstration, anything like this. And now you have to be alert and look. Keep your eyes up, otherwise this is going to fall to the floor, like usual. So, anybody's concerns, anything that you would like to have demonstrated here?
Not really.
No.
No concerns. No. Everything's just...
Yeah, for now.
Okay.
Mitähän sitä olisi? Ei nyt tule vielä. No, en mä keksinyt vielä.
So one more throw and then we call it quits. At least we get small exercise because we always pick
them. I believe this is a microphone.
No, I don't have any questions.
Yeah, okay, so let's keep it there. So why am I slightly worried? Why do I have this slide? Because I get these random comments that there are things that are quite hard and quite difficult and time-consuming. And then I walk through supervised sessions which are half empty. So there's this dissonance. Supervised sessions are almost empty, so people don't want help. And then there are this murmuring that this is really hard. So I'm just trying to balance this in my mind. In case you just didn't manage to get the cube and you have some worries, I would recommend coming to the Slack. I've been very happy to see a few students who are active in the chat forum and asking questions and answering questions for on my behalf. So kudos for those people who have done that. But am I correct in assuming that, you know, you are all who are present here doing pretty much fine? No any obscenely hard exercises or anything. Everything's going well. Okay, surprised. But anyways, great. Great if there's no problems. So let's do a few more type exercises, just to make sure that we have ground this concept to the ground. So there's one thing that we haven't yet done. So this is one of these, can you implement a function or value of this type? Can you make something like this? First two are functions. Next two are just plain values. If it somehow weird, feels weird to have just plain value and ask if you can reasonably implement these, you can imagine that these are also functions from bool to this one. Doesn't actually make any difference whether it's function from bool to that element or not. Same for these. Why do we do this? Because these are these values possible? These are the corner cases of the type system. So if you have a working idea how the type system works, then answering this kind of a question is quite easy. If you don't have a working idea on this, then answering that is, you know, quite hard. And it's supposed to lead to a discussion about how these things work, why these things are not possible. So, you know, click in your answers privately so you have something to discuss about. And as a hint, if you have no troubles with exercise like this, then I have these appointment times on Fridays. So if you have troubles, you can't really solve these by yourselves, book an appointment on Friday. And then you have 20 minutes of time with me, and I can explain and answer all questions that you have about these things. Probably not questions in general. Okay, 12 answers. 19. How many of? Yeah, I think we should get at least 25 answers before proceeding. 31. Great. So, can you implement? Okay. So, this answer is somehow slightly contradictory. Do you want to discuss in groups, or shall we throw the mic around? Groups. Okay. So let's have the usual 220 seconds of group work. And as a hint, these are not so great.
Eka ei pysty, mutta en mä kyllä oikeastaan, no B:n pystyy, mutta en mä se sitä edes yhtä.
Okay, so here's the result. And it seems that, you know, only measurable difference is in the last column. So less people think that this is implementable. So I think based on this, we have a slight problem. This is not working out. I'm either explaining this wrong or there's some conceptual mistake. Okay, first one. This one. The person with the mic or the yellow box. Okay, are you on the red side or the green side?
Red side.
Okay, what's justification?
Because it returns anything, a list of anything.
Yeah, and you don't know what the anything is.
Yes.
Okay. Is there anyone on the green side of the, you know, raise your hand and you get the box. Okay, look behind you. Okay, why can you make this?
You can return the empty list.
Yes, yes, obviously. Well, not so obviously, because it's a hard idea. So we can always do, you know, function like this. We don't care what the argument is. We return the empty list. That's just great. And there's nothing here that actually constrains the type to be anything. In specifics, when we make a list of type A, we don't actually need an A to make that list. We can return an empty list, and that's fine. There doesn't need to be anything inside. Okay, conversely, if I read this kind of a type signature in my code, I will obviously know that this list is empty. Because how could this function, you know, invent an A to put inside this list? So only implementation, it has to be an empty list. So there's exactly one function that does this. Well, naturally, if you make these weird functions, you use error or undefined, throw an exception, or make an infinite loop, then you can, of course, make whatever types you like. But with sensible functions that don't crash or loop infinitely, well, yeah, you can make this. Well, certainly you can make this, because now you know more about your A. You can actually return something that is, you know, not an empty list. You can return a list of numbers. You know, there is possibility to generate a number, you know, any num A, you can build it. There's a method called fromInteger in that type class, and you can make, say, take a zero and convert it to whatever number type the caller is asking for. So this definitely, if this is possible, this is even more possible. The difference here, we know more about this function. The first one, we know that it's going to return an empty list. This, it can return, well, whatever set of numbers you can imagine. It's like all, you know, ascending numbers, you know, Fibonacci numbers, you know, digits of the pi. So we, this is less constrained and it needs more documentation. The first function needs no documentation. It's obviously, it's a, you know, really silly way of converting a bool into an empty list. Never know where you could actually use that. Okay. Most of you think that either A int, this is possible to make. Why is it possible?
Sitä voi ottaa pelkästään sen lukuarvon, että jättää sen huomiotta sen A:n.
Yes. The answer translated is that, you know, either A int, it's either left or right. To make it using the left constructor, you need to use an A. If you use the right constructor, yeah, you can use an int. You can make an int. So, rather obviously, well, yeah, this works. No problem. There's nothing to constrain this A. So there is no A inside this value, so it's okay to make. As a hint, you can throw that away or you get to answer the next question as well.
Eturivi.
Okay, good. So, okay, this is possible. How about this one? Which side are you on, green or red?
On the green side.
Okay, how can you make this one?
You can return the second one, which is just an int.
No, you have to return a pair of A and an int.
Well, the A can be anything.
So, would it work if I said...
Yeah.
Okay, throw the mic around. This gymnastics component is, you know, I don't know if it's fun for you, but it's amusing for me. Okay, do you agree? Is this thing, does it have type pair of A and int?
Well, I'm not sure anymore because I'm too confused.
Okay. Okay, well, you can't. You can't, because if I write something like this, if you say colon set plus t, it will allow, it will print out the types as well. So if I write 42 here, that doesn't have type A. What it has is type num A, A or num T, T. So that's a number. And since I am the one, or whoever uses your definition, gets to choose this A, this definition should work if I decide that A is a string. And, well, ain't a string. And if you would try to implement it like this, the one who is using that function can decide that A should be a number. And now it's a string and another number. So the answers are yes, definitely yes, yes, nope. Is this clear? This is not very hard concept, but this needs a different perspective. Needs something to, you know, click here before it's obvious. Any questions at this time? No. So, yes.
The last one that I didn't get the point why it's account implemented.
Let's say. Can I write some kind of an example of this? Suppose that we have a value in some module you have defined. Something like this. You have an x that is of this type. Now, this is your definition. This is in your module. Then your friend picks up this module and decides to use the x. So now when you use this thing x, you can I? Okay, this might fail, but let's try. There is an extension to GHI which allows me to practically do this. So let's make this kind of an x. Yeah. So here we have defined this x. So consider this as a given. It's a module definition that you have written. Now, the one person who is using this, well, he can take the x. And he can, of course, pick out the second element from the x, which is going to be an int. Then, if you pick up the first element, what's that going to be? That's going to be an A. Now, implicitly, when you use a term that has a type variable inside, what happens is that you actually first instantiate the proper type. You replace the A with something. And Haskell makes this kind of vague because this happens automatically. So what really happens is that, you know, let's take a test expression. So I should be able to calculate x plus 5. Well, because x is an a, I can decide what the a is. I can decide it's an int. So I should be able to calculate this. So what happens under the hood is that first, you know, the compiler is going to see this. Then x has type A, it's a type variable, so the compiler can instantiate the type variable. It says that the first type variable is of type int. And probably never have learned how to use this. Come on, Antti, help me. No. Okay, so what happens is that it first is going to replace the A with type that is fits to this formula. So first, it's going to look at the X. It's of type A. A is a type variable, so it can write anything it wants on the place. So it can write, for example, int there.
So it's defined that X as a int, not as a pair int.
Yeah, let's put like first, use the first element on. So now this should work. Because, yeah, it could be any kind of a number, like whatever. So when I use this, I decide what the A is. I always decide some A. It has to be some concrete type. Or the compiler does it for me. It automatically decides that, yeah, that X has to be an int because otherwise it won't type check. Now when you are implementing this, this constrains you. You have to make any possible type that you like. So there is no type that is simultaneously, for example, an int and a string. Yet the one that is using the x can decide that the first element of x is int. The second guy can decide that x is a string. But there is no value that is both at the same time. Okay, I'm having this feeling that I have dug myself a really deep pit and falling in that. Okay,
under the process now.
Yeah, so basically the whole idea is if you use something that has a type variable, you decide what you write in place of the type variable. And this leads to a conflict, because you can decide it's an int, it can be a string or a bool. Then the implementer, the guy who is implementing this value, has to make some value here which has both the type int, string, and a bool. And one thing can't be at the same time int, bool, and string. Okay, confusing, but the confusion is mostly due to me and not the topic, I guess. So, when you go to sleep tonight, spend at least 30 minutes about thinking about this. Definitely you will fall asleep before 30 minutes. Okay, on the Y side, here's my promised spelling error. It's luckily not irrelevant. So, why can you implement a function like this? Takes a boolean and returns an arbitrary b if the b is a num. Three options. Think for yourselves. What is the reason? Why? What's the best explanation why I can do this? Okay, I guess most of you have answered. Yep. So let's see about this. Okay. So the why is important as well. You have to have correct justification on, even if you have the correct answer. So, what we can see here, you can extract B from num B, which is absolute nonsense. It doesn't make any. It's, num is a type class constraint. B is some kind of a type. It's a constraint. It says that B has to fulfill these contracts. It's a totally different sort of an object than, a type. So you can't really extract anything from it. It doesn't even exist on the actual type. It's just a limitation of that type. But these two. I think, you should argue. And there is only one of these are correct. So which one is it? Not giving you more hints, but let's do one more of this group thingies.
Vaikka täällä olisi joku muunkin tyyppinen tässä boolin paikalla, vaikka siellä olisi stringi.
I still have to remove this bong sound. It's hugely annoying. Now we get the correct result. So the fact that you can somehow, you know, write up conversion rules to convert booleans into, you know, say true is 1 and false is 0, whatever, arbitrary mapping like this, it has nothing to do with the actual problem at hand. The problem at hand is that we have to return a b, and we know that b is some kind of a number. The boolean is totally irrelevant. If we are thinking about the types, it really doesn't matter what the function does. Only thing that matters is it possible to create a b, a value of type b? And yeah, it is possible to create value of type b because num has this nice from integer method that allows us to make arbitrary numbers. So yeah, I think this is clear. I think, yeah, great. And now we have spent, you know, half of the lecture on the first two, you know, side note things, and we probably won't manage all the slides, but that's usual. And understanding the type system, it's much more important than knowing how to do proofs by induction in this course. And why is this so important? When we get to advanced topics like functors, applicatives, and monads, and stuff like this, you understand them through the types and not through the actual computations that happen under the hood. So if you don't know how to read the types and or have a lacking mental image of how these work, it's going to make learning these advanced topics really hard. Conversely, if you know how these work very well, then things like monads are absolutely trivial. It's all about the types, really. But then let's go to these program properties, or the actual topic of this lecture. So this is about writing correct code. That is, I guess, the goal of, you know, every program. We want to write correct code. No one wants to write code that is wrong in interesting ways. So what is the difficult idea around here? There's this software testing course here that teaches you these economical ways of finding the maximal number of bugs in your program or faults. But how do you decide that a program is faulty? You know, how do you recognize that this program doesn't work? Well, obviously, if it crashes when you click on it, then it doesn't work. But programs can be wrong in all so many subtle, tiny ways. And conversely, what does it mean to have a correct program? You know, when is your program correct? It's another bit vague, you know, idea. Is the program correct when you can sell it for money and people keep using it? It's one definition of correct program. It can be still hugely frustrating and lose data, but if people use it, then it's correct enough. And finally, you know, disbarring this previous definition of it's a sellable program equals it's a correct program, how do you know if you have a correct program? Now, this is the big issue. We write some code, and we never want to give this code to our customer if it can break on his machine. And this is horrible. It can cost really millions of euros to ship broken code. You know, like Finnish Railways, for example. They had this huge problem that they couldn't charge their customers for, you know, I think something like 2 weeks. You go to the train with a credit card and then just, you know, can't charge your credit card, so you travel for free. You know, this went on for several days. It's a bad business. So that's the ultimate goal of software engineers, make programs that don't fail. However, how I think people actually write programs in the large is that we don't really that much design our programs. We might have these huge design documents that specify that this is the stuff that you want to implement. And usually we might, you know, browse through this document and find out that the intention is to make something like, a bit like this. Then you start writing code, or then you think with pen and paper and you elaborate your idea. You start with a very vague idea, then you write code. The code probably won't work as you want it to work, but you have a better idea on how to, you know, what is the thing that you are actually doing. Then you write it again, expand your code, you get more and more clear idea on what is the end result that you are actually aiming for. basically, I'm claiming that when you start to write code, you don't exactly know what you are going to do. So you're going to do something like that. And only after the fact that you have written the code, you know that what your goal really was. And this is why these small exercises in all university courses are really bad, because you know you have been given this exact definition, you have to write this, and you are completely missing this elaboration phase. You don't have to think by yourself how this thing really should work. For one, because it's very hard to grade exercises like this. So, fact is that if I'm correct with this, I think I'm correct, you might disagree, is that this is a very leaky process. If we don't have exact idea of what we are writing until we have written that, then yeah, there's these phenomena like the golden path effect. When you are writing a program, for example, let's take a program that the university library uses to lend and return books. So basically you take a book, press the lend button and feed the book in the machine and you have lended the book. And when you return the book, you press return and beep. Simple thing. And when you think about this process, it's obvious that you are going to think about this, just the scenario that I described. You pick up the book, you lend the book, you return the book. And most often when you write a program, this is, you know, you have this scenario and that scenario will work. Now, however, what happens if there is a guy that picks up a book from the shelf and presses the return button and then feeds the book into the machine? No one has lent that book yet, so some database query is going to fail, and if you are being really sloppy, the whole program will crash at that point. So you're pretty much guaranteed to get correct the specific scenario that you are programming for, but you are not so good at getting correct all these, you know, alternative scenarios how things can go really wrong. You know, why would anyone return a book before borrowing a book? Yet, you know, if the program crashes, someone is going to find something fun to do with this. So you can't allow that. So the idea is behind this program properties that we should really try to make it clear what our assumptions and intentions are. So we can answer, you know, exactly, does my code work or does it not work? So it's a way of documenting our assumptions of our programs. So, for example, you are so going to run out of time, but let's consider this. This is the levels function from the previous lecture. If you don't remember what this does, it goes through the binary tree and enumerates all the levels in the binary tree. First element is the root, then the, you know, items on depth 1, depth 2, and depth 3, so on. You can check the slides for the previous lecture if you can't remember. So this is the vague intention. Here is the elaboration as a code. So what should hold? So what would you expect from this function? Well, this is actually a hard question. How do you, what are the exact things that you can expect? Obviously, you expect that it will give you the individual levels in the binary tree, but that's quite hard to express. That is the idea that we are trying to express with our code. Instead, we really should look on the sides. You know, does this have, you know, some other properties? You know, number of elements, for example. What other things on the periphery would hold? So suppose that you, for example, convert this binary tree into a list, compute with the lists, something like this. Do you get any ideas? Spend a few minutes talking with your friends. What are the things that you would expect from this piece of code, other than the stated purpose of the code? So what would hold? Yeah. Okay, so this is not provoking very aggressive discussion because the problem is actually quite hard. You with the microphone, throw it somewhere.
Back row.
Yeah, I warned about this, but still amusing from the front of the classroom. Okay, what should hold? Any ideas with you on the back?
No se varmaan toimii kaikilla binääripuilla. Vai kaikilla mahdollisilla.
Yeah, and translation, it works for all possible binary trees. Excellent idea. And it's, you know, this is the first thing that you always want. It actually works for all inputs. It doesn't crash, for example. So, great. Let's list it here. Yeah, and this is hugely hard to test, actually, because how do we test all binary trees? Okay, few more. Throw it around. I think, you know, throw in the middle. I think we have something there.
Baroka.
Can I make a special request that you make this really heavy and spiky next time? Okay, any ideas there?
No, meni. Huomattiin se binääripuu myös, mutta eipä tultu muuhun tulokseen.
Okay, pass it around. If someone wants it, you know, wave, because otherwise you, it's going to be a random noise. Just shoot it somewhere. Okay, any ideas?
Oliko meillä hyviä ideoita?
En tiedä.
Ei mitään lisättävää.
Okay.
Listan listoja palauttaa. Muusta ei oikein niin kuin, enempää ajua.
Okay, throw it around. We need at least 3 or 2 much.
So we were thinking that maybe it could have some additional properties, like it, if it goes through the list, so it can give us the depth of the list, or tree,
yeah,
or height of the tree, or number of roots or leaves, or number of the leaves, not roots, but something like this, and maybe the highest or lowest values.
Okay, I got the first one. So first one was that if you I have n levels deep, I get n lists, basically. Second one was?
Like, give us the number of leaves, how many leaves in the whole tree.
Yeah, so... basically like this.
Yeah.
So there's have to be, all of the elements have to be present in the
Yeah, because it goes through them, it checks them, so it can gives us some.
Yeah, excellent ideas. Does anyone have any more? Not listed here. No, keep the mic. So, yeah. Works for all input. That's, can't really figure out how to test this actually yet. ND trees make for N lists. Yeah, that I can test. That I can easily test. So first I need something to calculate the depth. Any binary tree will do an int is fine. Empty binary tree has depth of 0, I guess. So I have root of v and a left and a right subtree, might be a little less confusing if we shoot around. So how do I implement this? Any ideas? Okay, obviously, no. I can do this. This is actually a very nice technique. If you are stuck with making a recursive function, give a name to these recursive calls. So we get left depth, which is the depth of the left subtree. Right depth, which is the depth of the right subtree. And now when we have names for this, it's a rather much easier problem. So I have a tree. Left side is this deep and the right side is this deep. And we have this root there, so something like this. Pick up the maximum side, add one. So then we can reload. Yeah, it compiles. We have this example, binary tree, depth of this example. Yeah, it's three levels. I just does it exist already? I just defined it. It didn't exist more than 3 minutes ago. So levels seems to fit. Depth is three. There's three levels. Yeah, great. Seems to work. Lists have the same number of elements as the tree. Well. Count all of the elements. Well, obviously, empty tree doesn't have any elements. And if we have non-empty tree, well, this is, I think, easy. Count all the elements. Right. This is obvious, right? If it's not obvious, wave or scream or do something. And then we can again test. So how do I get this clumb all the lists together and just compute the length, 7 elements in the list, and then count the seems to work. So we have nice properties. And well, then the thought is to, can you make some kind of implementation of the levels function that has these properties but fails? That's how you continue playing this game. Okay, so look at the periphery. Number of elements, adding unit elements, things like this. Okay. Next thing. Usually these are about interactions. I'm not saying that this one function is correct or wrong. I'm going to claim that this bunch of functions works nicely together for some definition of nice. How many of you have done this exercise where this was one of the prompts? Did you? Yeah, only a few people. So a very short discussion of, say, 2 minutes. What would you expect? What is reasonable to expect from these functions? Words takes a string, splits it into, on every space character or every white space character and makes a list of strings. And unwords just, takes a list of strings and clumps them all together. If you have GHI, just try. What are the essentially, what would you expect of how these functions interact? 2 minutes, go. Okay, I think we shall start throwing the cube around again. So you have the cube, just throw it around somewhere. So, words and unwords, any relation between those two? So, if you don't have, just throw or pass it around.
They're like reverse functions of each other.
Yeah, meaning that if I, you know, compute words of some x, whatever x, and, you know, clump them back together, I should get the same x. Okay? Yeah. This suggests one other obvious thing.
Herraila keskellä.
Yes. Yeah, you are exactly correct. Okay, any other? Yeah, you have the mic. Any?
We thought that maybe one assumption could be that if you have some letters in X, then when you do this words, it will at least the letters will still be in the result or something like that. But that's what we thought.
Yeah, cool. And this holds for both of the functions. Okay, and one obvious is that if I do this on the other way around. Well, yeah, and now we can test. We have some peripheral information, some boundaries where our implementation should lie, and we check these. So, can I this is your example. You have spaces in what? Wrong order of. Doesn't work, like you said. It's going to eat the spaces. It's either going to eat all the spaces, or it's going to be able to return words that are completely white space. So it would have to either keep the white space, or it needs to eat it away. It won't work in any other way. And obviously, the converse. If I have list of and I do it the other way around, it's also going to eat this. Okay, this is a different kind of a beast. This is not something that we implement. It's not our own code that we are testing. We are not actually really testing code. We are testing our assumptions about code. So the bug is not in the words and unwords functions. It's in our heads. And this is a, you know, interesting idea that you can have bugs not only in your, you know, computer program, but you can have bugs in your thoughts or intentions about your programs. And the later bugs are, you know, more dangerous. You should have a very bug-free head. It makes your life easier. So this is a way of, you know, you start thinking about these properties, you can test them, and you can find out that your original thought is probably not so correct after all. Okay, I have too many of these. Shall we? Okay, I guess I can leave these as a homework. If I change a character into lowercase, back to uppercase, do I get the same character? How many of you think if I, you know, just take a character, turn it into lowercase version, put it back to uppercase, that this is going to result the same character? Hands up if you are agreeing with me. Okay, hands up if you don't agree with me. Okay, who is the one with the mic and hand up? Closest hand to the mic. Yeah. Hands up again if you had your hand up. seconds ago. You think that it's not going to work if I change the lowercase and back to uppercase. The result is going to be different. Who thought this? So.
No. Eikö siinä ole, jos sulla on sekaisin isoja pieniä kirjaimia, sitten sä vedät sen to loweriksi, niin se laskee ne kaikki pieniksi, ja sitten sä vedät ne takaisin ylös, niin sitten on kaikki kapsilla.
Yeah, and translation. If I start with a lowercase letter, I turn lowercase letter or lowercase a into a lowercase a, and then I turn it to uppercase a, which is different from the lowercase a. Yeah, it doesn't work, but it's reasonable to assume this. It's a bug in our mind, and everyone thinks this for the first, you know, few minutes. Also, with the advent of Unicode, this is a really hairy question, because we have these nice things called ligatures, ligature. How do you pronounce it? It's these characters that you clone two Fs, for example, in one symbol. So we have Unicode symbols like. It looks like this is one symbol, FF. It's a special thing. You find all German words, you have this S symbol. Can't pronounce that either. If you take this one character and convert it into uppercase, well, there is no uppercase for this, because there's no legitimate clumped together character for two large Fs. Which means that if you take a string, convert it to an uppercase, the string length can change. And you know, one Apple computer software had this bug. You could crash all Apple messengers by taking advantage of this. So this is very effective technique. You know, figuring out these properties is going to clear out the bugs in our heads. So why are we doing this? Initial assumptions are never trustworthy. There's this nice book by Daniel Kahneman, Thinking Fast and Slow. If you have not read this book, your next goal in life should be to read this book if you are going to be a programmer. It has nothing to do with programming. It's an excellent book about this.
Sorry, what was the name of the book?
Daniel Kahneman, Thinking Fast and Slow. So basically, the guy proposes that we have this intuitive system that, you know, our first answer is going to be generated totally different mental processes than when we really think about this thing. We are intuitively, we are fast, but almost always wrong in these analytical questions. But we have this other way of thinking, you know, thinking slowly about this thing, which is painful, slow, and usually results in a better answer. So, you know, we have to think about these properties because we are so often wrong. Our initial assumptions are wrong, so we have to stop and rethink and make sure our assumptions are correct. It's even worse if we wrote our code ourselves because we had this specific scenario in mind. We had this specific problem that we were solving. We never figured out that this problem has instances which we never thought about. It's the unknown unknowns. For example, returning a book that has never been lended. That's really something that you have to think if you are making any kind of a system. And writing and checking properties, whatever means you have at hand, is a very nice way of doing this. You just look at and think what would hold for this kind of a set of functions. Then after a while, you probably really understand what the functions are doing. You have written some six or seven properties and tested those, and your mental image of these functions is immensely clarified. So, however, finding these properties needs practice. Here is a checklist. Use these mathematical properties, like unit elements. If you add an empty list to somewhere, it's not going to change anything. If you add zero to a sum, it's not going to change anything. Multiply by one doesn't change anything. You know, you can sometimes reparenthesize. Doesn't really matter in which order you compute sums, for example. And you have these things that if you are summing a concatenation of two lists, well, why not take sums of these parts separately and sum them together? Rules like this. And things like sorting a list twice doesn't hurt. It's bad performance-wise, but you know, you write a code, there's some list that you need to make sure that it's sorted. You don't know if it's sorted already. Sort it again. No bugs there. If this wouldn't hold, life would be really awful. Other reverse. If you reverse something twice, it's going to be the same thing. If for some case reversing a thing twice doesn't result in the original item, that's going to cause huge amount of problems in future, because things like this. For example, the unit elements, one of the nicest examples that I have encountered is older Windows APIs. The minimum size of a window has to be 1 pixel. Can't make 0 pixel sized windows. So all of the programs, you have always one special case. You get 0 sized windows and you have to do something weird in all of your programs to handle this. So anyways, things like these are nice. Programming would be very nasty if even these basic assumptions wouldn't work. Try something like this when you are thinking about the properties. Okay, properties make your mind clearer. That is big benefit of them. But the second benefit is that they allow you to use this nice tool called Quick Check. This is, you know, way of testing if your assumptions are correct in a, you know, bit more effective way than we just did. And Quick Check, it's available for most languages. Most language implementations are good. Python implementation especially is a great version. It's called Hypothesis. You really should use it if you are not using it yet. And Quick Check is, let's do a simpler version first to get the idea what that is. Quick Check, it's an elementary idea. It's a thing that you give a function to. For example, Quick Check is the testing driver. And let's have something like this. We write a Boolean function taking x. Give that to Quick Check. And Quick Check is, did I not import that? Oh yeah, Pixie. What it does, it checks the types of this function, automatically generates 100 test cases, and checks that this works for all of these 100 test cases. Bang. Yeah, doesn't work. Here's the most simple test case that it found. Yeah, it's says that this doesn't work. Yeah, and it doesn't. It actually eats the string. So what else we can check? We can make these funny properties. Like what was given to me from the back row. If I split something into words, then, you know, I get a set of lists. I just smoosh all the lists together, just put all the lists there. And if y was element of the original list, it's going to be element of the list that has gone through words. And there is this implication arrow that is defined by Quick Check, meaning that this holds if this holds. This is a not very nice test, but it's good enough. And what happens? It gives us a counterexample. Doesn't really work. We have this special character slash f. I have no idea what, you know, that is. Blah, blah, blah. Yeah. No. It's a form feed character. It's something that has to do with, you know, age-old printers and stuff like this. You know, skips to the next page. Yeah. And that is apparently something that the words on words doesn't like. That's going to be eaten away. And okay, of course, my test is, it's vague. It's really hard to figure out strings and characters that the character is always in the string, so it generates thousands of, you know, bad test cases. The canonical example, white space, space characters, these are going to, you know, be eliminated from the string. So at least doesn't really work for all characters. I mean, all letters, you know, will be in the result of words or unwords. Not true. White space and special characters might not be in there. So that's one. Then these two upper to lower. We, I guess, know the result already. But how about the levels function? So this is a demonstration of how you can use quick check with your own data types. And this is going to be a bit nasty because it relates to things that we are going to learn next week. But so what we are going to do, we are going to test these assumptions. Works for all input. Now we have a reasonable way of doing this. We have quick check. So it's not going to test for all inputs, but it's going to test for, you know, 10,000 inputs, which is probably okay. We can do that. We can have these n-deep trees make for n lists. That's probably a good starting point. First, we have to, however, engage in a bit of black magic to make this work, which will be clear in, you know, a few weeks. So problem is that quick check, you know, it doesn't know how to generate binary trees. So we first have to tell it how to generate binary trees. And anything it generates belongs to type class called arbitrary. So this is a type class like show, ig, or num. And if we have something that is has this constraint, we are going to claim that this constraint holds for binary trees as well. And then we have to tell it how it holds. So we have to write this function called arbitrary, which tells us how to, you know, generate arbitrary binary trees. And I'm going to be lazy. I'm not going to explain this really well. Wait until end of next week and then check the quick check documentation. In two cases out of three, it will be an empty binary tree. And in one case, it's going to be, and this is a bit weird, branch containing an arbitrary value at the root, arbitrary left subtree, and arbitrary right subtree. So if you are wondering about these symbols, that's going to be the topic for the next course. It's just basically how you feed arguments to these special generated type functions. So this is for first argument, these are for the latter ones. Don't worry about these. So if I can spell it correctly, and yeah, I have to tell that this is a pure generator, and now we can get all kinds of funny binary trees. Completely random, mostly empty though, so we don't get too big inputs. And now we can start checking. So n-deep trees make for n lists. That was our assumption. So we take a tree. depth of that tree is equal to length of levels of this tree. Okay, how many of you think that this will work? Hands up, given my implementation. Yeah, almost all are thinking that I'm tricking you. And yeah, it does actually fail. There's this weird binary tree. Notice that quick check, if I don't tell it to do otherwise, we'll use this empty type on this unit type as a value. So this is basically simplest Haskell value possible. It's a type open parenthesis, close parenthesis, which has value open parenthesis, close parenthesis. So type that doesn't really do anything. But we have a problem. You know, most of our examples are going to be really large still. So there's another method in this arbitrary class, which tells me, and this is the key point in quick check, you know, generating arbitrary inputs, testing with these, great way to find bugs. But for finding useful bugs, you need to be able to shrink your arbitrary inputs. Doesn't do anyone any good if you have this huge binary tree and our code fails. We can't figure out what's going wrong anyway. So we can tell quick check also how to make our trees a bit simpler. For example, we can do away with the tree completely, take the left or right sub-branch. And now, knowing how to make the input smaller, these are randomly generated trees smaller, we get rather, you know, simple test cases. So how do we work with test cases like this? This technique is called pretty much declarative debugging. So if we don't get the number of lists that you said we would, there's obviously a bug in this levels function. So we check the definition. It's like this. So we know that this input is going to fail. So obvious first thing is check if it works or not. And yeah, it doesn't really work. There's two nodes in the tree, and the levels, it returns me just a single element. Actually, it will be easier if I give these names. So it returns only the root element. Okay, what next? It's going to return the root element. Yeah, it's here. Then it's going to calculate the levels of empty tree, which is an empty list. And then it's going to calculate levels in this other side. Still, we would expect to, typed too much. So these are the two things that we have. This list of, one level and this empty list. Then what happens next? We use this chip width to combine these two things. The empty list and the list with one inside. And what happens? Chip width is not working as we assumed it to be working. It produces a list that is, it cuts off on the shorter list. So chip width, empty list, anything is going to be empty list. It would work if both of the branches would contain something. Then it would be okay. And this is why, at the end of the last lecture, I wrote my own definition for this. You can check how it's really done. So, yeah, doesn't work. and very easy way to get extract bugs from your code and your thinking. Try these at home, especially the upper and lower. Okay, before we go, a few words of warning using QuickCheck. It's very simple tool. It's just checking for random inputs. It's going to default for 100 tests, which is very few tests for most cases. So if you have a complex function, 100 tests is, it's not going to catch anything. Also, which usually trips up people, is that when you ask QuickCheck, and I really don't know why it's programmed this way, you ask QuickCheck to, you know, check for, let's say, something idiotic, like sorting list of X's is same for as a reversing list of X's for, you know, arbitrary list of X's. This should really be false. And yeah, let's put sort in the scope. It says, yeah, works. No, no, next time we are writing a code, we need to write a sort function. We can just reverse the list, much easier. Except for the fact that this thing is cheating. Since I haven't told it what type to use, it's going to use the simplest possible type that it can figure out, the unit type, which has just one value. And obviously, if our lists contain things that have just one value, sorting, it's not going to do anything for the list because it's already sorted because every element is the same. Reverse, well, it's not going to do anything because all the elements are the same, so if you turn it around, it's the same list. So this is bad. This is really, really bad. So what we do, we add type annotations. You can annotate sub-expressions by using this double colon and type, saying that XS is a list of booleans. And now we get something that's reasonable. Doesn't hold if the list is false true. Yeah. Can't even think of any other example to show us. So always, if you are doing something like this, make sure that you give a concrete type to QuickCheck. Otherwise, it's going to, you know, give you nonsense answers. Finally, rare cases are rare. If I write, you know, let's prove that there are no strings that contain cats. Yep. There is no string that is equal to this constant string. Again with the big C. And we can do this all day. We can give it tens of thousands of, you know, inputs. It's never going to figure out that there actually is a string that has these specific letters. Why is this so hard? Because, you know, with the Unicode, we have millions of characters. Even with ASCII, we have something like, you know, 250 characters. So there's 250 ways of selecting the first one, power 2, selecting the second one, power 3, power 4. It turns out that we need, you know, millions of test cases to, you know, actually hit this one. So if you have something that requires very specific input, QuickCheck is not really going to find it. For that, you need something that is based on some solver technique, like any SMT solver, or what was it called? This, I think, this is a nice tool. It's for C sharp. And let's see. Okay, this is an equivalent problem written in C sharp. It basically says that there has to be an array with some very specific number in some slot of the array, and there will be an exception. And this is, you know, you can notice it's taking a longer time than quick check. It's very smart tool, and it figures out that with this exact input you get this error. So if you are a Microsoft programmer, your life is a bit easier. So this is something that you can never do with quick check, but there are tools that, you know, really read through your code and figure out how to get to any branch you decide. So with quick check, you can't rely on rare inputs ever appearing, and you have to be slightly careful about the distribution of the data. Okay, few words about proofs by induction. We have 3 minutes left, so let's do it quickly. No one really likes proofs by induction. Just two notes. This is the hard answer. This will catch all the cases that quick check doesn't catch if you are, you know, mentally strong enough to use that. You know, most of us are too lazy. There are two ways to mess this up. If you are doing a mathematical proof, you cannot rely on intuition. You know, you can't, this is an exercise most of you have tried this, I guess. You can't have these kind of steps that obviously this function is going to return something like this. Obviously. Well, that's not a proper proof step. You have to really make the inductive assumption and work with that. Because at this point, if you are doing something like, obviously this thing holds in my proof, then you are, you know, proving something about your intuition about the code and not about the code itself. Second one, Antti Juhani asked me to remind you about this. You can't appeal to repetition when you are making proofs by induction. So you can't have steps repeat until list is empty and some result you want. And this is not a proof. It turns out that, you know, you can write almost anything you like using this technique, prove any absurd claim. Just, you know, hide it in the three dots somewhere and everything's going to be nice. Instead, when you want to use this, just, you know, make the inductive assumption, use the inductive assumption. Done. It's easier to do it that way. Finally, 2 minutes, yeah. One way that Haskell is special is that we have theorems for free. There's few questions on the slides, but I'm just going to explain the topic very shortly. If we have function map, which applies something to all elements of the list, and a reverse, which turns the list around, then we can pick any function h, if it doesn't throw an exception or go to infinite recursion, and this will hold. We have this rule, this always works. And why does it work? Because of the types. We can see from the type of the reverse that it can only rearrange the elements in the list. It can throw away some, it can rearrange them. We know that map can only apply this function h to one element at a time. And if we do this both, yeah, reverse, it's going to, you know, rearrange the list. We know that map is going to, you know, work element by element. It's not going to rearrange the list because it's known map function. Then there's no possible way to select the reverse or h in a way that this wouldn't hold. So we get theorems for free. It's basically the types themselves tell us how things are going to work. It's not possible to, you know, avoid type system. These are the properties you have for free. Don't have to prove them. It's obviously correct. Based on the same thinking that we had in the first few exercises, what are the limits of functions using type variables? And yeah, few other examples. You know, these are going to hold, basically because they have the types that they have. And here is the paper that you want to read if you want to have more of these. Okay, done, I guess. At least I'm completely done. Next, type classes and functors. We are going to talk about these.